This is The Guardian.
Während ich fahre, achtet der High-G-Beschleunigungssensor in meiner Apple Watch auf extreme Geschwindigkeitsänderungen. Der Gyrosensor achtet auf plötzliche Richtungswechsel. Und das Barometer reagiert auf Druckänderungen, wenn ein Airbag ausgelöst wird. So kann die Apple Watch Autounfälle erkennen und anbieten, Hilfe zu rufen. Ich muss einfach nur fahren. Die Apple Watch Series 8. Jetzt mit Unfallerkennung. Die Zukunft der Gesundheit. Am Handgelenk. Erfordert ein iPhone 8 oder neuer. Abhängig von Abdeckung und oder Verbindung.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Open the Carabao Cup box and let's go as Manchester City win the trophy for the 25th year in a row. A 2-0 win over Chelsea, in which they dominated for large parts, even if Graham Potter's men had their chances. Holders Liverpool are through too. Creven Kelleher, the hero at home to Derby. In other shootouts, never talked about Gillingham win at Brentford. Blackburn succeed at the London Stadium. And Newcastle beat Palace. Arsenal had turned over at home to Brighton, while Spurs failed to turn up for the first and second half at Forest, while Antonio Conte says Harry Kane is really, really tired. Aren't we all, mate? We've got the final Premier League preview of the year, and we're pretty sure we know the England squad, which you will know by the time this comes out, so we'll discuss it and correct ourselves on Monday if Gareth springs no surprises, Southgate springs any surprises. All that, your questions, and most importantly of all, does Barry actually think he's going out with one of the Bangles? This is the Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Robin Cowan, welcome.
Hi there, Max. Yeah, I'm just wondering, is this why Barry isn't here? He's like...
Well, who knows? We'll get into that in part three. Hello, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan.
Good morning, pal. You all right?
I'm very good. And we'll explain who the Bangles are to Ben Fisher when we discuss it. Hey, Ben.
I'm Max. How you doing?
Very good. Joe says, excuse me, where is the Carabao Cup box? And why haven't we heard its glorious roar in years? One of my favourite pod moments pre-pandemic. So here we go. Editing in the Carabao Cup box from 4 years ago. Carabao! Oh, how nostalgic. And in fact, on that episode, Derby knocked out Manchester United. Jose and Paul Pogba fell out and Phil Foden scored his first goal for Manchester City. So how time flies, eh? Let's do what happened in the last couple of days then. Man City beat Chelsea 2-0 in the sort of tie of the round on paper. And City had all the play, I guess, Jordan, but felt like Chelsea had the best chances early on in this game.
Yeah, they did. They did. They'll be kicking themselves. And I think it's been the first really good performance from Chelsea in a few weeks. I've got a few Chelsea friends. My dad's a Chelsea fan. He was saying last night that, you know, they gutted, they went out. But they're more encouraged by the fact that they pushed City, albeit an inverted commas second string City team, all the way. But I think Chelsea have kind of bigger problems in terms of just getting the trust of the Chelsea fans, the trust of Graham Potter. Many of them, I think, like the idea of having this progressive, relatively successful in terms of whether a Brighton manager at their club. But the reality of actually, is this guy the guy that can maintain our high standards? There's still a lot of concern about whether he is that guy. So I think what their main issue is just buying into what this guy can do and will he get time? And people talk about time at Chelsea. I don't think the biggest issue is the pressure from the owners. I think it's from the fan base. Will the fan base give him the time to really implement what it is that he needs to do after being spoiled for so long for so many trophies? So despite going out, they'll be a bit gutted, but I think they will take encouragement from the fact that they can put in a good performance against the best team in the country. Caveat, not Arsenal.
Yeah, no, very good point. Well made. We'll get to Arsenal and their brilliant result against Brighton. Robin, I mean, Jordan makes a good point, don't they? Because actually, as a fan, you need to give your team time. And if they, you know, Pulisic has that chance, Lewis Hall, who I didn't know a whole lot about, creates a great chance for himself and then doesn't take it. And when you're watching as a fan, it's quite hard to go, actually, if they go in, that changes this game and then we might have a win against City and then it's a real confidence builder for us.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. I think, imagine, especially as if you're a fan of Chelsea, to just be happy with a good performance. It's just not, that's a very sort of, as fellow fans of League One teams. That's all. That's what sometimes what we can grasp for. But
hey, happy with even a bad performance, just happy with something happening.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, a corner.
yeah, we'll take it.
Slim pickings for us. But yeah, I think you're right. They were very. I thought they were very unlucky here. Really unfortunate. I imagine they had the better chances. It's just Mahrez obviously sticks one in from a free kick, and then. Koulibaly kind of doesn't really track his runner, Alvarez, to put it in for the second. And yeah, I mean, Lewis Hall looks very good. I do wonder if we'll see him a bit more. But it was a bit like that with Billy Gilmore, wasn't it, a couple of years ago? I think it might be an EFL Cup or an FA Cup game. He was really, really good. And now he's at Brighton not playing. So I guess we'll wait and see on that one.
Also, Jordan, I mean, in that free kick from Mahrez, and I don't want to dig out Koulibaly too much, but he didn't seem to jump in the wall. I don't know what his instruction was. I certainly wouldn't jump if a ball was going to hit me in the face. But it's all slightly tricky if everyone else does and you don't, and then the ball goes over your head.
Yeah, it didn't look really good. And I'm wondering, like, what the hell are you doing? And he did it kind of confidently, like he was told, like, that is what you're supposed to do, when clearly that wasn't instruction. So it was.
I don't need to jump.
Yeah.
Maybe there was no draft excluder. I can't remember if there was. He would say, listen, I can't possibly jump if there's no draft excluder. Anyway, City are through. I mean, we sort of, I don't know, because City win it all the time. And I know they didn't win it last year, Ben, but it would just be nice if City had a few years off the League Cup, right? You know, they go for the other ones, don't they? Let them fight out for the Premier League. Let someone else have a turn.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to envisage them not going, really deep and being popping up in the final and probably going on to win it. Although I did see that I think Charlton are the only London team left in the competition, so that's a bit of variation and makes life a bit interesting. I mean, I know the League Cup gets a lot of flack. It's sort of derided. It's the kind of ugly duckling of the cup competitions, I suppose, but I do think it's great. I know Premier League clubs don't really think of it that way. Often Championship clubs don't either, but I think it's a good competition. And Forest have gone through against Spurs, and one club will probably, maybe have a run to the final, which, I think is good. So, whether it's Forest or, I don't know, whoever. Leicester, for example, were really good on Tuesday. They did that game against Newport, and again, it was a bit of a non-event as a game. And I suppose the people who criticise the competition would point to that as a case in point. But, Leicester could go and get a trophy. And I think for them, for example, especially after a bad start to the season, that's something they are really targeting.
In England terms, Robin, we saw Calvin Phillips come on, get him on that plane. We think he will be on that plane.
Yeah, I think he will be. I heard him on Five Live on Monday, and he was very, very confident. I think it sounded like he'd had sort of a heads up that he'll be there. And I'm not surprised. I know there'll be people who say, look, he's barely played, and that's a valid argument. But he contributed massively in the Euros, and Gareth Southgate places a lot of weight on, players who've performed for him. And not necessarily sort of consistently for their clubs. I mean, we've seen that before. So I'd be absolutely astounded if he's not named in the squad.
And look, we'll get on to players who he hasn't played much. We'll get on to players who've played a lot and will be on that plane and might be sleepy in a little bit. Let's go to the Emirates. Arsenal 1, Brighton 3. Jordan, look, Arsenal will be brilliant this season. I guess you probably don't mind them going out. And actually, Brighton, I thought, was superb in this game.
Brighton were brilliant and worthy winners. We've got a really bad record against Brighton, actually, in league and cup over the last 4 or 5 years. It's really weird. They beat us at the Emirates last year in the league as well. They were the better team, but I am a little bit conflicted with this one because I also the League Cup is one of those kind of almost easy cups to win. It's not that many games for Premier League teams. I just think to myself, just kind of put it in for five games, and you're in a final and win a cup. So I'm a little bit, just get that one in the bag. It's an easy trophy to win in that sense. However, our squad isn't the biggest, isn't the strongest. Our depth isn't amazing. So you do feel like back end or the end of the World Cup, second half of the season, there's going to be a lot of games for teams like Arsenal with the Europa League, the Premier League, the FA Cup. And then if you add on top of that, the League Cup as well. And unless Arsenal are planning to recruit heavily in the January window, you do feel it's maybe one cup that you could just maybe do without to kind of make sure that you give yourself the best chance of doing better in the two competitions that I think they really are going for, the league and the Europa League. So yeah, I'm a little bit gutted because I think it's a cup that we could have won. But equally, you know, bigger fish to fry. And if there's one L we've got to take, I'd rather take it in this competition.
I think if Chelsea fans, you know, want to be patient to, you know, give Potter time, they should just look at how well coached Brighton are, Robin. I mean, some of their football is pretty, their second goal was beautiful.
Oh, both of them were so good. And it's just their recruitment's just absolutely astonishing. You know, Mitoma, and the way they bed them in, they usually go back out on loan somewhere and then they come back in the Premier League. You know, we've seen that with McAllister as well. But they just pick up such technically gifted players and they're just a brilliant team to watch. And I think what's great is that, yeah, maybe the actual Brighton fans do get slightly frustrated when they don't score, but like the expectation isn't there. So it's like, you know, it's not a Chelsea or an Arsenal where you're expected to win all the time. They can have that freedom to kind of play well and maybe not win all the time. I think they're just a beautiful team to watch. Really, really good.
Julio Encisco, who is a Paraguayan, and Jeremy Sarmiento, an Ecuadorian, who I had not heard of until yesterday. You are nodding, Robin. So, like, did you know? These two, I wasn't sure if it was, you know, sometimes someone's got one name on their back and they're called by a different name. I was like, well, they're these sort of nippy little players. Is that the same person? I better check. But, like, yeah. Who are these two? I've not seen them at all.
Yeah, well, again, they just kind of bed them in. I know Sarmiento because I am doing Ecuador at the World Cup and he is probably going to be in the squad. And they've also got, I mean, Ecuador have got Caicedo as well, Moises Caicedo, and also Estupiñán from Brighton. So it's quite a big contingent there. So, they've come through these South American countries. I mean, like McAllister and their recruitment's there. Just on a different point, round four of the EFL Cup is due to be played the week of the 19th of December. So that is before the first round of Premier League fixtures. Yeah.
Oh, right.
So I'm just thinking, yeah, that's not going to be particularly, I can't imagine there's going to be very strong teams being put out. So that's like the midweek before Boxing. So Boxing Day is when the Premier League
hang
begins,
on.
Right?
Does that mean we don't even get like a week? Like, no. I was definitely right. The World Cup's done. I'm going on a mini break to Amsterdam. Can listeners get in touch? Do we really need to cover the? I mean, we're trying to say the Carabao Cup matters.
We need to see how Charlton get on. That's the only London club.
Can we field a weakened team for that pod? I'm just gonna need a bit of time off. the scheduling is mad. We're going to talk about the Premier League fixtures this weekend, which will be odd, won't they? Richard says, is it odd that I'm glad Arsenal are out of the Carabao Cup so we can focus on the league, but find it equally hilarious that Spurs are out? Meanwhile, Darren says, why did I decide to support Spurs? And why did I think this season would be a good season to buy my first season ticket? Spurs, Ben, with a novel approach here of being poor in the first half and then surprising their opponents by being even worse in the second for a change.
Yeah, not a good result for Spurs or Conte. Obviously tried to change things up a little bit.
But only a little bit. I mean, that's the thing.
I mean, but that's what I was going to say. The team was more than ample. You know, Forest are okay, but they're not, you know, they're beatable. And Spurs, I don't know. With Conte, I mean, it's strange because I thought he was really onto something this season, but it just feels last few weeks like the grip slipping a bit. I know they came back at Bournemouth, but that I found quite alarming. As you say, obviously the performance at the City Ground is poor. And then I don't know, the squad is a lot better really than they're getting out of it at the moment. I think there's some really good players there, and I'd be concerned if I was a Spurs fan because I just feel like Conte is a really good manager and he should be winning those games.
I'm with Ben in terms of, I think Conte's a brilliant manager and but I think the vibe amongst Spurs fans is definitely changing. They're slowly questioning him. And I think that's a massive mistake. People compare, this the tactics from what he's doing here at Spurs with what he did with Inter and Chelsea, where he won things. He's doing the same thing. The only difference is the caliber of defenders he had at those two clubs enabled him to get to half time. The plan is get to half time in the game and we have Hazard and Costa, or we have Martinez and Lukaku. We're going to win 75, 80% of our games. That's going to get us third, second, and even first. Spurs don't have that. So while I think Levy has backed Conte to some degree and done quite well in that sense, I just think if you look at Spurs' defenders, they're all average at best. There's not a brilliant centre-back or defender there. I think if you give him a centre-back and a wing-back of his liking in January, I really think Spurs can do something. And Spurs fans will be frustrated because they will see this as one of the two trophies they could win this year, and they're out of one now. So I think that, and okay, the football's not exciting to watch, but if you're a Spurs fan, and I caveat this again, I'm an Arsenal fan, so I don't want to tell them how to feel, but as a Spurs fan, you haven't won much, and you've got a brilliant manager there. Stick with him, back him, and I think Spurs can win something, if not this season, next season for sure.
Just looking at the goals they conceded, just again, really passive defensively, and I don't know, Max, do you feel like Christian Romero is like the really aggressive defender that was kind of like, no, you're not getting through here, and that he's just a big miss?
Yeah, I think that is true, and I think they're very one-paced if they don't have Son or Richarlison. I know Richarlison came on and Kulusevski came on and makes a big difference. But I agree with you on the passivity, not just, you know, defending, but when they have the ball, they're so passive in terms of their play. And actually, especially if there's no, like, Bentancourt, if he's not in the midfield, then there is no one who is going to pass it forwards ever. Like everybody gets it. You know, the wing back might get it and then put his foot on the ball and go back to the centre backs. And I understand, like, conserving energy, at least I think I do. But, you know, it is, and look, they have had injuries, right? They're not the only team. And you know, they will go into this break probably fourth through in the Champions League with a winnable draw in the Champions League. Like, top four is a good achievement for Spurs. But it is tough when, you know, the game is hard to watch, right? This game was hard to watch. Like, Forrest scored Renny Lodi scored a lovely goal, but you're right, they all stood off him. Spurs fans will see the irony of Serge Aurier picking out a man with a cross in the build-up to Lingard's goal. And Forrest played really well, but they didn't actually have to do that much. A big story here, Ben, is Harry Kane, who did look pretty cooked. And I thought that watching him, and I was surprised he played. And Conte saying he was tired, really, really tired. Yesterday we had a soft training session. At one point he stopped himself to recover energy. He's okay, only fatigue, and that's normal. I mean, there are England fans and an England manager who'll be thinking, you know, that is not a position where England have massive depth. And he is key. And I can just see another group stages like the Euros where he just looks knackered.
Yeah, we don't want him sort of half-baked out in Qatar. I think, it's a bit worrying. I don't really know what Conte's trying to do. Is he trying to sort of sow the seeds that Harry's going to have a miserable tournament? Or, as you say, I mean, England, we are very reliant on Harry Kane. There's no two ways about it. I think, did he really have to play last night? I don't know. I find that a little bit worrying in itself. A team like Tottenham literally don't have supposedly any other options. I know you have injuries and things, but I don't know. That to me is a bit worrying. But in terms of Kane, England need him for every minute. So if that is the case, I mean, I don't quite know what he means by sort of has to stop in the session and then, you know, is he sort of down on his haunches and kind of.
It's a really Sunday League image of just someone going, just going off the pitch to vomit because they had a heavy night, isn't it? Or just, I'm really tired.
Maybe he went Walkabout or Yates's or something the night before. Maybe had a little energy drink. I don't know quite where he is. I'd like to think maybe Conte's painting a bleaker picture than Harry Kane actually feels, but we'll soon find out because we're not too far away from that opening game. Just on Spurs as well, I was going to say, do you think anybody likes a sideways passer as much as Tottenham? I'm just thinking, like, looking at Ollie Skip in there, no offence to him, but he's probably a candidate for that role. And Harry Winks seemed to be the classic one of those, and obviously he's out on loan now, isn't he? Obviously gone there permanently to Sampdoria, but
I mean, Harry Winks passed it forwards a bit more than the current midfield, but I got told off for being very negative about Spurs the other week. So, you know,
I'll do it.
Can I also add? I really liked this quote from Christian Stellini, the assistant coach. He basically said it's not their problem about the World Cup and Harry Kane. who was like, we just take care of him for Spurs, so we're going to play him as much as we want. And I really like that, honestly, because I think every league manager just wants to say that, but they kind of go, agreed. Oh, well, you know, we want them to do well at World Cup. But he's like, we don't give a shit. No, he's our player. Screw you.
Yeah. It's like they go out in the group stages. Liverpool got through on penalties against Derby. Great entertainment in this shootout with, you know, the Derby keeper basically on the penalty spot when he saved the first one. And then Kelleher saving one and then Firmino putting it over the bar. You know, it was great entertainment. There was one moment in this game, we'll rattle through these games, but it was nice to see David McGoldrick again, who I haven't seen for a while, sort of not quite taking a chance, which is very David McGoldrick. Ben, I mean, presumably you're more aware than I am that he was now at Derby County being very David McGoldrick.
Yeah, he was one of several players that Derby signed in the summer. He thought, oh, they've got him back. You know, where's he come from? Obviously McGoldrick had that really good season in a bit at Sheffield United, to be fair. But I know what you're saying. He is that kind of player, isn't he? Probably very frustrating to watch, I imagine, if you're a regular at Pride Park.
Yeah, I mean, look, it wasn't a simple chance. Sort of 5 minutes to go, was it? Header was slightly behind him, but that was the big chance for Derby County. But look, they did well to take Liverpool to penalties. No extra time, by the way, is absolutely brilliant, isn't it? It's one thing this competition has got right. Gillingham won 6-5 on penalties at Brentford. Charlie says, are the team excited for Gillingham's Carabao Cup win this season? An amazing result, Robin. They had 20% possession and one shot on target. That is world class.
I love that. Yeah, as a travelling fan, that would be exactly what you want. That rear guard action, riding your luck, and winning on penalties. I mean, yeah, you can't ask for much more. And a lot of noise around Ivan Toney scored his penalty, obviously. I actually don't have any idea if he's going to make the squad. But great result for Gillingham. I think Brentford, they are desperate for the break. They think they've got Man City this weekend. They're not on a good run.
Might as well be a break now. They might as well just say, we're on the break now. This game doesn't matter. And actually, that penalty shootout, everyone was kind of influenced by Ivan Toney. It was just lots of people being very chilled out, just rolling it into the corner. Yes, Jordan?
Just briefly, speaking of penalties, I don't think I've ever seen 19 better penalties taken than I saw at the London Stadium yesterday between West Ham and Blackburn. Apart from the one that missed, obviously. I think it was a Bonner hit the bar. they were amazing. They were all really good.
There is a moment in those sort of penalty shootouts where you think, this might go on forever. And I hope it does go on forever, because that really does... That really affects the fixture schedule, doesn't it? Like this could actually, like, just somehow just go on for days and days and days. They just can't play their next fixture because they're still in the penalty shootout with Blackburn. But anyway, a good win for Blackburn Rovers. A bit more pressure on David Moyes. Newcastle got through on penalties. Ferg says, should Nick Pope be subbed on for England's shootouts, Tim Krul style? What do you reckon? What do you reckon, Ben? I mean, Pickford's quite good at saving them as well, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, but I do quite like the idea of that. It just creates a bit of drama, and then you have that big controversy after, what was he doing? It was never going to work, you know.
I'm not sure Pickford's coming off without a fight in that situation.
I would sign up to that just for the fun of it all. And also, I remember doing a piece with Tim Krul and looking at the photos of his bottle with the names of the, you know, all of his homework on and stuff. And yeah, I got a lot of time for that because... You know, you people don't see the work they put in, so fair play.
Well, that was the Australia keeper, not Eddie Redmayne, Andrew Redmayne, who saw the Peru keeper had that on his bottle in the shootout in the playoffs and just lobbed it over the advertising hoarding and went, there you go, can't check that. Well, look, Pickford wasn't in goal for Everton. Asmir Begovic, was nice to see him, wasn't it? And he was there to concede four at his old side. Bournemouth, some very Carabao goals in this, deflections and... Mason Holgate falling over, etc., etc. But I think there was some sort of chat, and maybe just because there's not, you know, during Carabao Cup week, you've got to talk about something about pressure on Lampard here, Jordan. I don't know if you think there is or not.
I think there is pressure on Lampard. I mean, but weirdly, not amongst the Everton fan base. A lot of the Everton fans I hear from, I know a couple, they kind of keep spouting this, he gets the club line, and they seem to think that he's really bought into them as a fan base. And I think he's got a lot of credit in the bank for how he's saved them again, inverted commas, last season. I'm not convinced about Lampard. I think he's a good manager, but can he take Everton to where I think they want to go? which I think is a, you know, at least mid-table, even Europe. I'm not so sure. Is that fair to put it all on him? Because the board spend, but they spend really badly. Maybe he's not the only one culpable in that sense, but I think there's people that don't support Everton looking at Everton and Lampard and thinking, yeah, we could see another spiral coming here, and he needs to arrest that very, very soon. The cup, again, a bit like West Ham, the cup is a chance where he could have really added to the credit in the bank he's already got from last season, if he could have really got them to the latter part of this competition, and that's now gone.
Leicester through, as Ben said, Lincoln, Burnley, MK Dons and Charlton, as Ben said as well, the only London side left in the competition. Southampton through as well, partially for Wednesday on penalties. Nathan Jones just been confirmed as their manager. Ben, a good appointment, question mark?
I think so. I think it's a very brave appointment. Nathan Jones has done a remarkable job at Luton, like beyond remarkable, really amazing. Obviously had them in League Two, got them into the Championship playoffs last season. Some of the players that he had in League Two are still there. Obviously, he's been there in two spells because he left for Stoke and then came back. But I do worry a little bit, because I think it's Stoke. It didn't work. That's the reality. It didn't work. It was spectacularly failed, really. And I think there the issue was managing probably a different type of player to what, with due respect, he has or had at Luton. And if that was difficult at Stoke, I think it's going to be the same at Southampton, if not harder. It's a very young squad at Southampton, and I think that will be good for him. And he can, you know, he can clearly develop players. James Justin, for example, at Luton, Kieran Dewsbury Hall, who he took on loan. You know, that he's got some track record for developing players. He's very well liked by his players and gets the buy-in. But at Luton, the mantra, if you like, is, you know, we work really hard. It's, you know, backs to the wall at times and team spirit and all of that. And I just don't know if some of that is, if you can mirror that, if you can sort of replicate that at Southampton, because it's just a totally different world, isn't it, in the Premier League. So it's a big challenge for him. I totally see why they like him. And it's a little bit, I suppose, like Graham Potter going to Chelsea. You kind of want these moves to work, because if it doesn't, it's like, oh, like, what do we need to do then? Do we have to look abroad and get this guy who's already the sort of done the thing, you know, who's done it before, which, you know, Hasenhüttl, for example, had managed in the Champions League. So, yeah, Nathan Jones feels like it's going to be interesting, because Hasenhüttl was never dull on the touchline, and Nathan Jones certainly can be pretty fiery, and I think we can see a few touchline kind of antics coming up, and no better place to start than Anfield on Saturday. So him and Jurgen Klopp going at it, I can already see being a few fireworks on the weekend, I think.
All right, well, let's carry on that Premier League preview in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, still a few tickets remaining for the live show at Earth in Hackney. If you'd like to snap up one of the last ones to see us in person, me, Lars, Barry, Ellis, James, lots of special guests, theguardian.com/guardianlive. Apparently the live streaming numbers are not as high as they were previously. Is that because, well, we've done Barry's Munich anecdote, so we can't better that? Or do you need to just have a long, hard look at yourself next Thursday and decide this is what you need to do? Because we'd love to see you. You can watch it on Catch Up as well. It's not quite yelling at the audience to buy a ticket, but buy a ticket. TheGuardian.com/GuardianLive. We'll see you there.
Susanna Hoffs, can we promise her? Maybe.
Can we promise any of the Bangles? Listen, we're trying. This feels like it'll be a very weird weekend of football, doesn't it? You know, players are dropping like flies. Just seen Sadio Mane is going to have a knee scan after he went off 15 minutes of Bayern's game. Win over Werder Bremen. I worry about this Premier League weekend. I just wonder how intensely teams will take it. I mean, you're at Spurs, Robin. I can imagine Spurs being as the least intense game you've ever seen, from certainly one side of it. I mean, Leeds will be intense, that's for sure.
I'd love Match of the Day just to be nil-nils and everyone just not touching each other. It'd be really great, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I'd love that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think if I was a manager, you'd play your Scots, your Italians, your Swedes, you know, who could afford to get injured and not miss the World Cup.
That's the moment when I've realised Sweden aren't in it, Robin. Are Sweden not in it? God,
no,
that's a blow, isn't it?
It is.
There we are. That's good for me to find out before the previews next week. Yeah, I think you're probably right, actually. I think selecting non-World Cup squad players might be sensible in this game.
Because even Leeds have got, so Aronson and Adams have just been named in the USA squads, and they're really, you know, they're full throttle. I mean, I can't see Leeds not being like that, because that's the only way they know how. But yeah, no, it is going to be interesting. It's totally understandable, isn't it, for players? Obviously, they want to be professional and play for their clubs, but, you know, World Cup doesn't come around very often, and for some, it might be their only chance. So psychologically, it must be really difficult.
Do you think, Jordan, like, players will get a calf strain in training? Do you think that would come into the minds of some of them? Do you think we'll see the starting lineups and there'll be surprises in each game?
I think there will. I think motivation is a really strong element here in terms of teams. I think part of the reason why Arsenal lost last night was because Brighton have a bit bigger motivation to do well in this cup than they do. And I think that don't underestimate how much a role that plays. I think I'm looking at some of the fixtures right now, and the teams that are the top of the league will obviously have more internationals, but then again, they'll have deeper squads, therefore they can rotate a lot more. So I think how managers play this weekend is going to be quite interesting, because you don't want to drop your better players that can get you the win. But as Robin has said, you also don't want to play those better players who are definitely going to the World Cup and are going to play at 75%. I think age plays a role as well. So some of the younger players that are going to the World Cup, who may have another World Cup in them, may be a bit more, they may go for it a bit more than, say, someone that's going into a World Cup and it's their last World Cup. They don't want to miss their final chance to go to World Cup as well. So I think the kind of psychology of how managers play this and how much the players, without realising it, go for it or not, I'm fascinated to see how that plays out this weekend for sure.
Harry Kane will score and everyone will think that he's doing the Ronaldo sleepy celebration, but he's just curled up for a nap.
Smackered.
I think Newcastle-Chelsea actually is a really interesting game, Ben. If it didn't have this kind of the World Cup shadow over it, we will, you know, when this game starts and we're watching, we'll see it as a kind of real who is most ready for the top four from these two.
Yeah, and I am really excited by Newcastle. I think obviously Eddie Howe's done an unbelievable job. Totally transformed the club in a year, which is amazing, really, from where they were and when he took them over. But as you say, I think it's the way he's got them playing, the intensity with which they play. Certain players are obviously really shine. You know, Bruno sticks out is an obvious one. Obviously, Callum Wilson as well. It'd be interesting if he's firing and maybe he's in the squad. But and for Chelsea, it's an awkward game because Newcastle are a really good team. They're in a really good place at the moment. But actually, even if Chelsea were to, say, draw there, that would probably be seen as quite a, you know, why have they not won? And obviously, especially after losing in midweek. And as Graham Potter knows only too well, you know, the crisis is so never too far away when you're at one of those clubs. Whereas obviously at Brighton, he was allowed to go on these little runs and things. And I think Newcastle is just a really tough game for anybody at the moment, because they're not the Newcastle that teams were playing, you know, a year ago, or even in the sort of early... maybe that's unfair, but you know, even early on under Eddie Howe, they're very different now. They're so much more well drilled. They're a really good team, and I think they've got a hell of a chance of competing for that top four, because they're going to strengthen again in January. But I think the key there is actually what they've already got, and it's really working. It's really impressive.
Jordan, Arsenal go to Wolves. There's such a high chance that they'll be top of the league going into this break, which you don't win any trophy for, but if they manage that, and even if they don't, right, what Arteta's managed in this few months is really extraordinary.
It is, and they've come through a really difficult October period as well, where people are like, that's going to be the test. If they can come through that, then we'll take them seriously. We're 9th to November, and you know, we're still top of the league. And I think even if, as you say, they go into the World Cup break second in the top two, I think is a phenomenal achievement. But I think, I mean, I'm not getting too carried away, because it's a long season. I'm going to fall into cliche heaven here, but it's one game at a time. And I still think for Arsenal, this might sound crazy, maybe a little bit defeatist, but it's still very much top four for me. If you can lock off and bank top four as soon as possible, and then you can start thinking, okay, can we finish third? Can we push second? Can we come top? And some Arsenal fans I know are saying, no, we need to push out our chest and we're top of the league. Why can't we win this league? And let's push City all the way. And I get that as well. But I think the job that Arteta is doing in just ensuring that we can try and bank top four as soon as possible at this stage, I think is a testament to the job that he's doing. And he's getting closer and closer to the point now whereby if they don't get at least fourth from here on in, that is an almighty implosion. So I think a few more games, either side of the World Cup, and you're kind of thinking that's a second team guaranteed top four spot and the rest are battling out for two spots. And then you kind of look into, as I said, can they push City higher? But I think the key for Arsenal is going to be recruitment. They definitely need a couple of players in the January window. If they can do that, I think other teams might look on Arsenal with a bit more fear than I think they already do.
Simon says, how does Jordan feel about Unai Emery at his hated Villa? Your pantomime feelings about Aston Villa. Ridiculous pantomime. This is the Guardian Football Weekly, Jordan. Surely you've got to put that to bed now. Surely you've got to go. It's done.
No, never, never. Those fans are really bad. They don't deserve someone like Unai Emery. He's a really good manager. I think we, as Arsenal fans, disrespected him a lot. It was the wrong timing for him, granted. But I think he's a high caliber manager that is not befitting of that football club.
Okay. Well, my apologies to Aston Villa fans for Jordan Gerrard Bryan's ridiculous approach to that part of this particular podcast. Look, before we end part two, I want to talk about Alex Fletcher, the Bath City player. We had an email from Connor who says, hi, Max and Cole. I was at Twerton Park yesterday evening for Bath City versus Dulwich Town in the National League South. That was very sadly abandoned after just 5 minutes following a terrible incident involving City standout player Alex Fletcher. The 23-year-old was tussling shoulder to shoulder with a Dulwich defender, both moving at full tilt towards the byline when Alex lost his footing, crashed headfirst into the concrete wall surrounding the pitch. Press coverage of the incident has referred to the walls as advertising hoardings, but in reality, these are waist-height concrete walls no further back than a yard or so from the touchline right away around the pitch. Fletch was very clearly immediately unconscious. The crack of the impact was heard right away round the ground. It was chilling. The paramedics on site responded remarkably quickly, and the 1,000 or so in attendance were deathly silent. After 30 minutes, a tearful voice announced over the PA the game was to be abandoned due to the seriousness of the incident. This morning, it's been announced by Alex's family that he received emergency neurosurgery, is in a stable but critical condition in intensive care. Right now, it's anyone's guess as to the fate of this promising young talent. I don't know Alex personally, but he's always been a joy to watch, a remarkably positive player with a fantastic work rate, often chasing down the opposition defence well into stoppage time when the side are winning 3-0. He just simply loves to play football, and he does so with an infectious smile. I'm devastated for him and his family. It was a shock simply just to be in the ground. I can't imagine what it must be like for his family, friends, and his team. It begs the question, what next for grounds like Twerton Park? To restructure the ground would be massively costly and disruptive. Any legal repercussions from an incident like this could completely threaten the existence of a fan-owned club. But it seems obvious in hindsight this was an accident waiting to happen. If nothing changes, will the players be comfortable on the pitch? Will they still close the ball down near the touchline? Or will there be forever a seed of cautious doubt in the mind? How many other grounds are there with dangerous concrete or metal walls within a few steps of the pitch? I'm not sure what the answer is, or if I'm even trying to make a point, but I thought it might be something worth bringing to the panel's attention. Best wishes, of course, to 23-year-old Alex Fletcher. I really hope he makes a full recovery. Thank you, Connor, for that email, and you know your first-person perspective of that. I think now is probably not the time to speculate about all of those things, but just to wish Alex the absolute best of luck in what must be a very difficult situation for him and obviously his family and all his friends and the club as well. And we wish you our very best. And that'll do for part two. We'll be back in a minute.
Während ich fahre, achtet der Hi-G-Beschleunigungssensor in meiner Apple Watch auf extreme Geschwindigkeitsänderungen. Der Gyrosensor achtet auf plötzliche Richtungswechsel. Und das Barometer reagiert auf Druckänderungen, wenn ein Airbag ausgelöst wird. So kann die Apple Watch Autounfälle erkennen und anbieten, Hilfe zu rufen. Ich muss einfach nur fahren. Die Apple Watch Series 8. Jetzt mit Unfallerkennung. Die Zukunft der Gesundheit. Am Handgelenk. Erfordert ein iPhone 8 oder neuer. Abhängig von Abdeckung und oder Verbindung.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. World Cup squads then. Bob says, are international squad announcement videos now a thing? Why are they a thing and how do we stop them? Ben, you were at the big announcement in Wales. How was it?
Yeah, it was really good. It was very different. The Wales squad announcement was at Tyler's Town Welfare Hall, the last surviving miners' hall in the Rhondda Valley.
God, they know how to play it, don't they? That's, you know.
Yes. Home of Rob Page and where Rob Page's parents still live. he popped home for a bit of lunch with his parents before making the squad announcement, which I thought was nice. Went for breakfast around the corner, and only a few miles away is where Jimmy Murphy, the 1958 manager, grew up. So there's a blue plaque there. So he went to visit that. It was very, day for the soul, I think. It was a good day. I mean, it just in very stark contrast to the USA, who did their announcement, by lighting up the Empire State Building red, white, and blue. This was very authentic, shall we say. And I stuck around a bit actually last night, and right at the end of the night, all the fans that were there for the announcement, it was like a ticketed event in the end. And when the squad got announced, it was like, wow, Dylan Levitt's made it, and etc. And at the end, the whole room sang, apart from me and perhaps a few others, sang the Welsh national anthem, which we know is a good one. And
you're like John Redwood, aren't you, Ben? You're like John. You just don't know it. You've got this gig. You don't even know it. It's a disgrace.
And it was quite the evening, actually. It wasn't your typical squad announcement, shall we say. And also because of where it was, there was road closures involved with Rhondda Council, which again is just another headache. And also that
classic
meant
Fisher,
a bit of parking potential trauma. But you'll be glad to know that there was no such problem.
So when they announced, like, did they do one player at a time, or did they do the whole, here's the whole
squad?
No,
they just beamed the squad on the big screens, and people kind of slowly sort of deduced that so-and-so had made it, or, Reuben Colwill was in, but there was no room for Tyler Roberts, etc. So, who is injured, I should say.
But did they, like, was it like a rapturous applause? I could just imagine England doing it, and just the fans there just instantly getting furious that there was no place for Ivan Toney, and James Maddison wasn't there, and just people just hurling bottles at Gareth Southgate straight away.
It was all very feel-good in contrast to that. And I think, also, there was never really going to be any surprises in terms of the squad, so that probably helps, whereas obviously Gareth Southgate can kind of do no right and... as we'll soon find out.
Yeah. So like for people like, we were speculating about Chris Gunter, but he got in, which is obviously feel good. Johnny Williams as well, plays for Swindon Town. He's there. Joe Allen's not fully fit, but he's in. It was basically everyone knew who was going to be on the screen. So everybody just applauded what they already expected type thing. It was like a beautiful but pointless exhibition.
Kind of. I mean, the biggest deal really was Tom Lockyer, the Luton defender, being recalled. So that probably underlines how, shocking or not shocking it was. But nonetheless, let's be honest about it. Wales' first World Cup for 64 years, they're always going to make a big thing of it. And, sure. Rightly so, fair play.
And realistically, and we'll do the previews next week and look at the groups in a bit of detail, like how difficult do you think it will be for them to get out of the group? Like, I think obviously they are decent. I think the United States and Iran are also quite good, and England are, should be good.
Yeah, they're definitely targeting to, stating the obvious, to get out of the group. They believe they can get out of the group. I think they've got a good chance of getting out of the group. I worry a little bit about the midfield, especially with Joe Allen extremely, I would say, unlikely to play in that first game against the USA. By that time, he wouldn't have played a competitive game for 2 months. Rob Page is admitted he's an exception to the rule, really. He's a special case in the sense that he's taking him, even though, he's not in a position to be able to play, for example, this weekend or whatever. But he wants him there. He wants to try and get him to a place where maybe he could play. Whether that's the first game feels a big ask. But I do worry a little bit about the thinness of the midfield options. They're not hugely blessed in that department, I would argue. But, I mean, Aaron Ramsey, to his credit, has been brilliant for Wales of late. So if he can sort of lead in that sense, then maybe that's a big plus.
Are we going to expect Michael Sheen to be part of the backroom staff for Wales?
Well, they've invited him out there, Robin. So hopefully Michael Sheen will be sort of bounding around Doha shortly. And Dafydd Ewan as well, who's the man behind their anthem, Yamohi. Oh, so I don't know who else might get invited out. Maybe they'll take a few more.
We need some hype men. We need some hype men for England and hype women.
It just doesn't work. It's just not the same. It's just there's nothing.
Stormzy or somebody.
It just isn't the same. Dave says, I've heard Southgate is going to take player X and leave out player Y. It's a disgrace. Insert a single stat comparison that makes player Y look better. Clearly shows that player Y should be starting for England. Should we riot? Hashtag Southgate out. Hashtag whoever follows Southgate out too. Look, here's what's being suggested by Jacob Steinberg and David Heitner in this paper. Marcus Rashford, Callum Wilson, Ben White, Calvin Phillips, Kyle Walker all in. No place for Maddison, Sancho, Jarrod Bowen, Ivan Toney or Tammy Abraham. Luke Shaw, the only recognised left back. I don't know if you can hear, my son is really having a bad time. I'm going to say he's very upset about the England squad, isn't he? Clearly, he's chosen England over the Socceroos. He's absolutely devastated to hear about James Maddison. Jordan, are you outraged?
I'm not. I'm actually going to George's Park after this podcast. By the time this comes out, as you mentioned, the announcement will be live. So I'm interested to hear who he goes with. I think Maddison will make it. I've been told by my sources that he's in, yeah.
Oh, really?
So not to say that the Guardian journalists aren't well sourced and aren't very good, but one of us is wrong. So
it'd be a massive surprise if Maddison's in. I mean, just given the sort of what Southgate has done for the last few years.
Yeah, the evidence suggests that he doesn't really change and make massive. I mean, massive surprises, but I've been told that the form that he's been in has been that good that it's you can't ignore it, and he does have a role for him to play. And I think he should go. I think he should go. I'm really keen to see who he does select. I think the whole he should pick this player, that player stuff, I think is really tiresome and boring. Whoever, as Ben alluded to earlier, whoever Southgate picks, it's going to be a lose-lose for him. So let's just trust that whoever he goes with, he backs them, and we judge him on the results of of where England finish. I just wanted to mention as well, I think that the press conference today will be dominated by not only the selection, but also by off the field issues as well. And I've got a couple of questions for him, one of which is a non-footballing question. And how he handles that, and he handles it very, very well, is again something I'm quite keen to hear.
Given that you will have asked the question by the time people listen to this, because there are so many non-footballing questions you could ask him, right? And it's you are tight for time. What are you going to ask him?
Sure. My football one is going to be, have you learned anything from the last two tournaments and will you tweak anything? And my non-footballer one is going to be, what's going to be the England, the FA's position on speaking out against issues that have been flagged beforehand, considering FIFA have come out and said, we don't want press conferences dominated during the tournament by non-footballing issues. He was very, very, I thought, impressive, Southgate, leading up to the Euros and saying, we're taking the knee. We know that large parts of the country are anti taking the knee. We're taking the knee. Get used to it. We're not moving from that. So I'm quite keen to see if A, he will abide by the, you know, not talking about non-footballing issues during the tournament. And what is the contingency if things do go wrong or if there are issues and there are protesters, will they speak on it? Will the FA have a stance on their position on this sort of thing? Or are they just going to focus on the football? And I think what he'll do is he'll take all of the non-footballing questions today, because I think it's a smart move, so that by next week he can justifiably say, look, I've addressed all the non-footballing things. We are now literally just in football mode.
Robert, do you have any strong thoughts on the England squad, what may or may not be?
No, I'm with Jordan. I find it very tiresome, but I'm with you. I'd find it very surprising if he picks Maddison, just from what's gone on. And he just, the system that we think he's going to play, there's just no room for James Maddison. And that's not to say that he doesn't deserve a call-up. He totally does. He's a fabulous player. But then you also think about, is he an impact substitute? Again, he might be, but we don't have really much evidence for that. You've got, like, you know, in terms of where do you actually play him, you know, would it be on the left or the right? Because he's not going to be a holding midfielder. And it just doesn't fit in. Whereas, you know, a Grealish is obviously, I think he's going to be seen as a big impact sub. So I think that's the big contentious one. I guess the other one is who's the other centre forward, isn't it, to back up Harry Kane. That's the big one.
Jordan, you were... in the WhatsApp group were mentioned the French squad. What, in terms of it's just really good, even without Kanté and Pogba?
Yeah, I just thought everyone was kind of salivating over the Brazil squad when it was announced, and rightfully so. I just thought the French squad is just an absolute joke. The midfield options they've got, the forward options, I think defensively they're probably not quite as good or strong as I think Brazil's lineup, but I would just love to see Brazil at their full strength versus France left, because I just think there's so many options there. Just, I don't think either will win it, by the way, but I just think just seeing the names they've got, and that's without, as you mentioned, Pogba and Kante, it's an embarrassment of riches.
That's interesting, because I saw a lot of people saying this doesn't look very strong, this French squad.
Oh, really?
That's interesting. Yeah.
I think up front, you know, Benzema, Koeman, Dembele, Giroud, Griezmann, Mbappe and Cuckoo is strong. The midfield, without those two, sure, you've got Camavinga and Tchouaméni from Real Madrid.
And Rabiot.
Rabiot has made it. Guendouzi's in there. You know, like, Guendouzi's okay, isn't he? But, you know, like... Fofana of Monaco, I confess I've not seen a huge amount of. Veretout from Marseille, again, you know, Marseille I've watched a bit in the Champions League.
Varane, who's not played so much. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they do have a lot of.
And Lloris.
Is Lloris. Lloris is Lloris. They have won the World Cup before. They've got a lot of strength. I mean, Saliba's playing very well, isn't he? Kanate's back for Liverpool. Upamecano is, you know, plays for Bayern Munich, is not terrible. Teo Hernandez down the left for AC Milan is brilliant. So, yeah, they've got a good squad, haven't they? Jen says, actually, you know, on the off the pitch stuff, and we have got specials coming out next week, but there are always stories about off the pitch stuff. Jen says, oh, hi Max, is there no talk in England or anywhere else about David Beckham and his horrible role in this World Cup? Or is he like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer here in Norway, a sacred cow who can do no wrong? I love the pod. Have Lars and Josimar on more often, our best exports by far. What do you think? What do you think, George? I mean, I find David Beckham's role in this pretty disgraceful. And I wonder if that the power that he has means that the criticism of him is less. He's got a new show out on Disney Plus called something like Save Our Squad, where he goes to East London and he shows the power of football. And you think, God, the hypocrisy of doing this, but you're taking tens of millions from Qatar, where you clearly... You don't care enough about the people there and, you know, the lives of the LGBTQ plus community, the migrant workers, women, etc.
I think there is a huge element of hypocrisy here, but I also think that we are all hypocrites to varying degrees. But Dave Beckham is not a poor man. He has a lot of money. He doesn't need the money. But I'm always a little bit uncomfortable about criticizing people for making money. And it's a job. He's an ambassador. He's making money. The problem I have is then, and this is why I think Gary Neville is getting a little bit more heat than David Beckham, is that David Beckham is kind of just like quietly being a hypocrite. Whereas I think the perception is Gary Neville is a very vocal hypocrite in terms of he's very vocal about issues, human rights issues, but yet he's going to be working, I think for, a Middle Eastern,
being
sports. You know what I mean? So it's a bit like, okay, we're grading levels of hypocrisy here a little bit now, but I think Beckham gets a little bit less heat because he's quiet in the corner, taking his big bag, but not preaching to the world about the wrongs of the world. Whereas someone like Gary Neville, who does, is then at the same time taking Qatari money as well. But I think it's all very, very unsavory and uncomfortable, but I'd say equally, I'm a little bit, because I put myself in that position. If it was me and it offered me that amount of money, would I take it? It's a lot of money. I don't know.
But he's already got... How much has he got already?
I agree, Robin.
I mean, if he offered it to you, you know, in our current situation, that's different, you know. But,
I'm a millionaire, Robin.
I still...
You know that
I didn't realise. Sorry. You're into crypto.
I actually think it's worse that... I take Jordan's point, but I think the fact that Beckham is, if you like, sort of quietly just going about his business and, you know, brand... Doha or brand Qatar, whatever it is, you know, World Cup, FIFA, I think that's totally just wrong. It's a lot
worse.
At least Neville, I know he's getting a lot of heat, and again, rightly so, but at least it's kind of his field. He's going there to kind of do the job he does.
Yeah,
I'm not comfortable
that's
with
fair.
It, but Beckham just sort of sloping around quietly, I mean... How visible is he going to be during the tournament? Is he going to be shiny on photos and, you know, smiling for, you know, autographs? I don't know. I do find it very uncomfortable. And the reality is, especially Beckham's attachment to the England team and England, and let's face it, this country, I think it's totally wrong that he's flying the flag for Qatar.
No, I think that's fair. That's fair.
I also think his, you know, the godparents for his firstborn son are Elton John and David Furnish. And I wonder what they would think about this, you know, being a country where being gay is illegal. I think it's totally disgusting. I think he does need more flack for this. He doesn't need the money. And I think he's someone, it's made me reframe him, because you just realise that he's probably got the best PR people. And we, you know, throughout his career and afterwards, everyone thinks he's amazing. And I thought that as well, you know, what a great guy, down to earth. And actually, this is just a huge misstep in terms of his reputation. And me being very cynical, I thought they went, right, David, you're going to have to join that queue for the Queen to kind of get your, you know, down to earth image back. And maybe that's, yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it is really damaged his legacy. And I just think because of the power that he has, right? I think within, certainly within sort of within the game, he has such a reputation that if you speak out against him, people will notice and go, oh, you're not part of, you know, and I don't know, you know, it's quite hard to sort of quantify what that power is, but also because he has such power, he legitimizes, you know, the fact that FIFA gave this World Cup to Qatar, and that's fine. If he's saying this is fine, the number of people, given his following and his reputation, the number of people go, do you know what? I'm not sure. I'm not really read a whole lot about it. But if it's, you know, David Beckham's a good guy, so if it's all right for him, then it'll be all right. That is the absolute worst thing that he has done, in my opinion. But yeah, for me, his legacy is completely shattered. Where should we go now? It's just about when Gerard Piqué was sent off at half-time this final match before retiring. He started on the bench, got very annoyed by Robert Lewandowski being sent off after half an hour, and appeared to follow the referee down the tunnel at half-time, and apparently said some very rude things that we don't need to go into. Are you still there, Jordan, because your picture's gone?
I am. Sorry, I'm just getting changed. I've got a train to catch. 45 minutes, I'm here.
Oh, this is very exciting. Wow. the first time ever, a naked Jordan Jarrett Bryan. As we move on to the big part of the podcast, the Bangles. So Stefan says, is this the time to talk about the will-they-won't-they romance of Barry Glendening and Susanna Hoffs? We're rooting for you, Barry. Dell says, is Barry Glendening flirting with an honest-to-goodness Bangle on Twitter? The second best performance by an Offaly man this year after Shane Lowry won the PGA Championship. One for the cork board, surely, Baz. Jamie, no Barry. Guess he'll be back on Manic Monday. And then Steve said, what are Susanna Hoff's thoughts on Ryan Lowe's time so far with Preston North End? To which Susanna Hoffs, who really shouldn't have got involved with, you know, these replies, replied, I'm afraid I only know Ted Lasso. But yes, Barry Robin got a reply from Susanna Hoffs, and I'm slightly worried he now thinks he's going out with her.
Well, I think that's a fair conclusion for him to draw. Why not? You know, let him have this one, Max. And, you know, and as you say, maybe... He can pull some strings, and that'll be the big draw for the live show. Susanna, she's clearly absolutely very active nice on Twitter, you know. So maybe
the Bangles live at Earth in Hackney, theguardian.com/guardianlive. Barry is he's taking a week off. He has been a bit like Joe Allen, selected for the squad for the World Cup, even though we are, as we have been for many years, unsure of his fitness. Anyway, that will do for today's pod. Must read this email from Moody. Says, Dear Max and the gang, I'm hoping you can give a little shout out to an avid listener of at least 12 years who, although being a sweaty red-faced Englishman, is getting married on Sunday in Florida. We met our good friend Graham Holford back in 2009 when we lived in South Korea when we taught English. The three of us found the pod, and it was an irreverent connection to life back in Blighty. Although we've lived oceans apart since, we have remained great friends, and inevitably the first thing we talk about when catching up is what our recent favourite bits of the pod are, rather than any of the matches we've actually watched. It was fortunate that Grambo, as he's called, has managed to find himself a wife, as until this point, one of his self-confessed greatest life achievements is when he had a minor Twitter exchange with Barry, them groaning in agreement about how shit it is when people insist on reminding you of the previous night's drunken antics. funny for Barry to agree on that one. Anyway, the best wedding gift from us would be for you guys to wish the sweaty, phone-losing, inappropriately sweary Graham and his future Mrs. Holford all the best on their big day. Would appreciate it if this was possible. Much love, Paddy and Moody. Well, look, from all of us at Football Weekly, good luck, Graham. Good luck, the future Mrs. Holford. We wish you a very, very wonderful day, and a happy life together. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Robin.
Thanks very much, Max.
Thank you, Ben.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Jordan. You look marvellous now you've put your jacket on for television.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Cheers.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Christian Bennett. This is The Guardian.